All right, so they've asked me to start promptly at 9 o'clock, so welcome back to day two of the ICMC. This morning we're going to have three presentations, a keynote, and then followed by two session tracks. This is the end user experience track, so just want to make sure you know that this is an additional track that was not the previous 2 days, or previous day where there was only two. First, we'd like to also thank our sponsors. Without their support for the event wouldn't be possible. Please take some time to visit the sponsors and their exhibit and the exhibitors in room 214, which is just around the corner here. We'll have breaks at 10:40 and 12:25. All the breaks and lunches will be served in the exhibits area, which again is in 214. As we mentioned yesterday, Wi-Fi is provided by the Shaw Center. You can find the information on page 7 in your book. The conference presentation slides and audio will be posted on the conference website. All the login information is on page 7 in the conference book. Don't forget, this evening there will be a wine and cheese reception in the exhibits hall. And there will also be, that's where they'll be departing for the Dine Around Ottawa. And that's an informal, on-your-own opportunities to have dinner with a group of colleagues and stop by if you need to register at the sign-up desk. Your feedback is important to us. At the end of the event, we'll be sending you an email with a link to a survey. Please take a moment to let us know what your experience has been. Also, one additional thing, wanted to make sure that they asked me to make sure you know that not all the sessions are lined up in time. So some of the sessions are 50 minutes and some of them are 25 minutes. It doesn't happen until after lunch or after the towards the end of the day is when it happens, particularly on the end user track. Some are 25 minutes, which don't line up with the sessions that are in the other two tracks. With that aside, our keynote speaker is John Geeter. He's the CTO of Thales eSecurity, and he'll be presenting here. There you go.
Okay, thank you, Laura. So good morning, everybody. I hope you enjoyed yesterday. I did. I wasn't here, but I enjoyed it anyway. For those of you who've seen me speak before, you'll appreciate it's not usual for me to be stuck behind a podium, so we'll see how that goes. But anyway, good morning. A quick note about this. You'll have read the synopsis, I suppose. What worries me in the world of crypto modules right now is how applicable all of our gained experience is in solving the problems that the new world is throwing at us. I think we recognize a lot of old faces around the room. We've all worked together in different companies in different ways, and I think that tells a story in itself as much as anything else. So what I'm looking at here is just a few things to think about. I know we all think about them sometimes. We never seem to think about them quite enough professionally, about what the new world is throwing at us in terms of securing it, as opposed to it just sort of buying our stuff, which is nice, but not ultimately for the greater good. Why this particularly comes to me is really just as a result of my moving around a little bit. I spent a long time in Encipher. Most of you with a history of crypto modules will know Encipher. Some of you even worked there. And then I took a bit of a change after a decade or so there to go and work at a much smaller scale. So going from building big crypto appliances to building below the chip design level at ARM, and then up into the software and mobile world, and now come back to Thales, who bought Encipher a little while ago, working on very large scale problems in data centers and in client problems in software and all over the place. And the thing that constantly strikes me is how bad of a fit there is between people who are building software systems and people who are building mobile systems and people who are building apps and people who are building server centers and people who work for governments versus people who don't. The fit is absolutely terrible and it's fragmented, and yet we come up with things like, still, you know, when will there be a FIPS 140-2, 3? It's Never, probably. But we're trying to come up with these one-size-fits-all things, breaking down the problem in a way that makes sense to us. And it worries me increasingly that we're not breaking it down in a way that makes sense to the people we're actually claiming to protect. And I think there are some things that we can learn from everyday experience that will actually help us to make better crypto module security products and things if we take a breather and step back a bit. So everything needs a graphic. The thing to remind us that worlds colliding isn't necessarily a bad thing, right? I mean, the theory goes that we got the moon out of it. The moon's pretty cool. So there's no problem with worlds colliding, with having disruptive events. Dinosaurs may beg to differ, but you know, if they'd had the wherewithal to build a laser defense system, they would have been fine, right? So there's no issue with things changing. There's not really even an issue with things changing really significantly. But the issue is, if you don't adapt and make use of the new information you're learning, you don't see it coming and do something about it, then we're going to be in trouble. So, first obvious thing, worlds colliding, mobile. And a lot of these things are not new. I mean, the conversation about mobile has been going on since even before 10 years ago. I picked this because this is kind of the 10-year anniversary of the App Store and the iPhone, but we still started to have these issues with BlackBerrys and things. I'm sure those of us who were around in sort of 2000, 2001, admiring all the government pack phones and things. So this has been a concern for a while. But I think it's time to recognize, if we didn't recognize already, that we can't stop this thing, that we can't constrain it, that we can't just issue somebody with a special handset with a special lab battery that's got a special crypto in it, and that will make it okay. It's not okay. It was a bad idea to begin with. It was okay when it was only 2,000 people. It kind of started to fall apart when it was 200,000 people, and now that it's 2 million people, you just can't do that. So what about mobile? Well, firstly, the really simple thing, the obvious thing about apps and data moving around. Again, we all know it. But what we sometimes forget is that we'll put a crypto module up in the cloud somewhere, and we'll put a crypto module in software down in the mobile. And a lot of folks like to enable SSL and call it a day, and they think that's good. And we've got these sort of, again, little pieces that protect the infrastructure. But they're all very device-centric in the end. There's very little in there that really understands what the data is doing. There's very little in there that allows the control to go in the right place. So even if you have an app provider or somebody who's putting out information, like, you know, simple things like email, or much more complicated things like business intelligence, all of these things that need protecting, they don't have the tools available to them to take full control, because you've got to work with what you've got, and you've got to work with what somebody else is dealing with. So one of the things I think we don't think about often enough is the fragmented nature of mobile, that I can design a system that, yeah, it works okay if I use Keychain and I lock down my iPhone and it only connects over TLS to my cloud center. I've got an end-to-end story there, but in reality, somebody else buys an Android feature phone. What do? I've still got to give them the information, because in the end, I'm not going to turn down a customer in order for them to comply with my neat view of the world in security. So the fragmentation piece, I think, is a problem. People are striving to get really decent security, and there'll be one handset that offers it, and they'll base their claims on that one handset, and then discover that the whole thing's blown apart in the real world. And this is something I think we have to just give up and deal with, rather than trying to bring everybody up. But much more interesting as a creator of these things is the design considerations, the life cycle. So I spent better part of 5 years of my life building security modules into not just phones, but in fact into the middle of that chip alone, which was itself being built into a board, which was being built into a flagship phone out in South Korea somewhere. Now, usually when you're building a crypto module or a security module or a key management piece, you'd think you'd have a few months to do that. You'd think you'd have a while to test it. You'd think you might be able to put it in for certification and have it run through and do all your evidence and find the flaws and fix the flaws and then release it. But that's not how mobile works. The way the mobile works is that they concentrate first on the graphics and then on the battery life and then on the apps and then on whatever marketing message they've got. And if you're lucky, you get 2 weeks at the end to fix the security. And they'd love to have a FIPS certified one or a Common Criteria certified one or the new ITC for the mobile device PP. But if it threatens their flagship app, or if it threatens the battery life, it's out. They're not going to do it. If it threatens any of the manufacturing stages. So these guys, this is a... that's actually the inside of a Samsung Galaxy S3, which is not so many years old. We're up to the S7 now. These guys would absolutely throw out the security piece if it threatened one day of production. Why would they do that? Because one day of production represents about 350,000 devices that they could make, that they put on their supply chain, that they'd get going. It's seriously disruptive. And so the idea that you can have a design, any kind of the design stuff or the certification stuff that we've been used to in FIPS, and I know there's a presidential debate later on about the FIPS versus ISO still coming over. I'm sure there should be one about the common criteria reforms that are due any time yesterday, next week, 2018, and probably never, that we're actually going to get real ITCs and a decent recognition agreement and everything else. The fact is, if we don't get our acts together, these guys don't stop. They're still going, they're still building their stuff, they're still putting information on there, people are still buying it. So all of this analysis paralysis we've got and sort of perfectionism we've got are not actually helping anybody. In fact, you know, I was at just in the coffee room about 5 minutes ago, just having a pre-conference chat with people about the ISO versus the FIPS stuff. And with the best intentions, we still got the comments of, yeah, we can't push it yet because it's still got some problems, and we can't do that because it's still got some, you know, it's not quite perfect yet, it's not quite ready. Which may be true, but one of two things must be the case if we're going to make any progress. We either have to just push it anyway and make it better in the field if we think it's sort of okay, or stop and do something else if we think that it will never be okay. What's not acceptable is this constant running round of just trying to polish this thing, knowing that it will never ever make it into the real world. Aside from that, though, that's just a sort of hobby horse of mine, really. There are technical considerations, too. Because these devices here have to generate their own keys. There's a bunch of things on there that control cloud access. There's a bunch of things on there that control pretty decent contractual relationships between them and movie studios, for example. You've got all the DRM keys. You've got things for downloaded trusting applications into the TE. That's the S3, so it doesn't have a secure element, but later ones have secure element chips on there. They've got root keys as well. Now, standard practice should be, as far as possible, that you generate this device's keys on the device so that they never get out there, and so that they're unique, and so that you don't have any nasty issues with the sort of backups or backdoors or stealing, whatever else. But you can't do that because they're too slow, and the boot chain doesn't comply with that, and the way that you enable privileged access to the really secret bits doesn't come up in the right order. So you've got all sorts of problems there. You've also got problems with randomness, a topic close to some people's heart, I know, because these things also, while they're supposed to be generating keys, and they're now first order citizens in cryptographic exchanges and in sharing data and encrypting stuff, in enabling access to bigger, more important systems as your mobile credential or as an app host, yeah, you should be able to generate keys, you should be able to do key exchanges, and you can't because the randomness is either not good enough, or the thing's too slow, or there's simply bugs in the implementation. There's things I'd love to tell you guys that I can't, that I know about, you know, not necessarily these guys, but chips in general are terrible at getting a decent TRNG in a commodity thing. Or because of very specific design criteria where you don't want these things to be different. When you're making chips on a commodity line where almost nobody makes any money at all, and the margins are razor thin, and the consequences of having one run go bad are catastrophic, a lot of work at the materials layer, at the physical layer, the manufacturing layer, goes into making sure these things are as consistent as possible. And so even when you've got things like puffs trying to give you some sort of extra help with randomness, they don't work in the end. And all of the economics of producing reliable, profitable, consumer-grade electronics are completely at odds with all of our science of trying to make stuff sort of all nice and random or whatever. Now, these chats, I always make a point of editing. Every presentation I give is edited on the morning of the presentation with something from the register. Because without fail, you know you will get something decent from the register that fits. This is today's one, it's kind of nice. I didn't cut out the synopsis in the end, but apparently, and I haven't read it yet, because this was just before breakfast, but apparently somebody's found a way of combining two low-quality random streams into one high-quality random stream. I'll believe it when I see it. But there we go. So people are working on this stuff, but it's slow, and it's very hard to prove in the end. So there's an awful lot of issues with mobile, which is absolutely not going away, and is also very diverse and growing, and the ideal world that a lot of our original crypto module standards and science and certifications and things have grown up on. Another completely old topic, in fact I normally don't talk about this at all anymore, this word cloud, which was ridiculous to start with, is really shouldn't have a name anymore. This is just business as usual. But nevertheless, there are some things, given that we're starting on a little bit of history, there are some things that are worth learning from what we call cloud. Largely because of this. I don't know if anybody particularly knows Mark Andreessen. I don't know if anybody particularly knows the full essay from which this soundbite comes from, but I suspect we'll all know the soundbite itself, which is software is eating the world. This is evidently very, very true. Everything is becoming virtualized. And we have to remember again that, you know, we're here at the International Cryptographic Modules Conference. I think almost all of us would agree that we're not really in the business of making cryptographic modules for their own sake. We're here to do security, and we think that crypto is a good way of doing that. Well, if you're looking at security, then virtualizing things changes the game quite a lot. And so making everything virtualized, software defined, and so on is clearly a bit of an issue. But it's worse than that, because it's also accelerating and magnifying the amount of data that actually exists. So if we're looking to secure information, and when software is eating the world and the world is virtual, then information is real stuff. I think we've all also probably seen the quotes from Rebooting Web of Trust about things made of blood and steel. The protection of this data is starting more and more to become protection of real things. So cryptography and information and InfoSec as we knew it has taken the place of armed guards and barbed wire and things like that. This is kind of serious stuff. And worse than that, this quote was, can't remember, I think it was 2012, it's maybe 3 or 4 years ago. The way the world moves fast, you know, this isn't relevant anymore, so software is eating the world. Yes, that was true then, but what's happened since then is that APIs have eaten software. Now, what we've seen, this huge expansion of, you know, basic thing of computing, right? We had five mainframes in the world, or six-ish, and then that exploded into personal computers, mini computers, and then that sort of compressed into the cloud. And once everything was virtualized and could be centralized, what we're seeing more and more is that folks are coming up with a single provider of a single function. So where, you know, virtualizing something that was in one office and you just make it software in that office, and another one in another office, another one in another office, everything comes together into the cloud. Things are wasted a bit. You know, it's not core business. I didn't really want to have my own identity system. And so you find somebody else who's already on the cloud, who's already got a good one of those, whatever that one of those is, and you buy it. To the point that we've seen at really big scales. So Google obviously is one of these things, but you can't hang a strategy or a forecast off a single company with the Maps APIs and things like that, especially if it's free. I mean, anything you use that's free is okay, but we've just seen really big hookups, for example, between Salesforce.com and Amazon Web Services. Big companies who are using each other's stuff because Amazon's better at storage and compute and Salesforce is better at intelligence, so do that thing. About 3 weeks later, there's a massive announcement comes out of Microsoft that they're hooking up with SAP HANA to do similar kinds of stuff. Again, this is great, but these are business models that are based on having one place that's handling something pretty serious on behalf of many, many people who all have different requirements and different needs and different qualities of data, and quite deliberately and necessarily letting all of that information out, because the only way these APIs work is by having data sharing, is by having open access, is by having mashups and things. And again, I think it's creeping up on us a little bit that mashups that use Google Maps and a local Rotary Club website, well, who cares? That's okay, right? But we've slid into a situation where all those same techniques and the same technologies and marginally this better governance are starting to run the real world. That's a bit of a problem. The other thing the cloud's doing for us specifically is that it is really changing the way that crypto modules are defined, used, everything else. So this is a coarse oversimplification, and I apologize for anybody who's not represented in my pure two-way split here, but you know, historically, when we started with crypto modules, hardware modules, you've got two camps, reasonably unified by FIPS and common criteria, but still very different in a number of ways. Not the least that when it came to augmenting and mitigations on things, typically you'd have the server end hardware security modules for sort of PKI for CAs for payments processing, and you'd have these guys with the secure elements, the smart cards, the SIM cards. And if you needed to augment something, you'd have physical security, locks, bolts on the one side, and then you had things like oscilloscopes and balanced logic gates and all sorts of other stuff on the other side, because there weren't very many use cases. You could split them into fairly decent two camps, and then you just concentrated on one half of the problem each, and it was roughly okay. I do remember, I'm not actually quite old enough for this, but I did a bit of historic reading early in my career on payments modules with regards to this chap here. So it used to be, before we had PCI HSM and before we had some of these other payment standards, the Visa HSM security module standard, which I'm willing to bet at least one other person in this room has read, in fact I can see one now, and maybe two, it included a whole bunch of environmental considerations, including things like, you know, if you made your module, it had to be reasonably network secure and you had to sort of set the thing up right. But there were lots of concessions that if you had two security cameras at these angles blocking, you know, the single entry door that you had into your site, then you could get away with not having some of the physical protection. And if you had an armed guard, in fact I think there were different concessions for the numbers of armed guards you had, then you could have other concessions on the physical security and stuff. So yeah, there really was a big assumption baked into it that you'd have some degree of extra physical security around this kind of data center thing, where there wasn't on these other sorts of things. What cloud has done, in a very simple way, is it's taken away all of those assumptions that you might have, because try as they might to look after your stuff, the people in the cloud are not paid, ultimately, to look after only you. And no matter how diligent they are in looking after you, they can't run an economic business unless they have some generalism in their security layer, in their operations and things, in the way that they treat everybody fairly, well, but not optimally for any individual person. What we also have with these guys over here with their smart cards and things is that they're being put all over the place, used for things that they never expected to be used for, wedged into use cases where their security is nice and high because they've got EAL6 and they've got all of this extra baffling, but users can't use them. People showing up with multiple smart cards, ordinary people who have to put a smart card into their laptop to start it up, or who have many, many cards to sort of tap into different places, it's just not usable. It's fixing the wrong way. But in a technology sense, another thing they're doing is things like this. Not only this, but many others. So once you've got an always-on economy with relatively unlimited bandwidth, things like blockchain become realistic primitives for use of in security, and yet they completely change the way we think about a crypto module. They completely change the walls that this guy would be standing in front of, they completely change where keys live, and they completely change the way you think about what needs to be secured and what doesn't. So I would hope that almost everybody here has looked at the marketing claims, at least, of most of the blockchain Bitcoin-y type companies and see what they're trying to do. Marketing claims, of course, never completely come true, but in principle, PKI could be completely rendered useless by blockchain. If you believe the way that things work, right? You can put these identities on a shared place, you can make sure somehow that nobody manages to brute force or take over the 51% of the nodes or whatever else. Yeah, there's some engineering problems, but were this to come true, or something like it, it's not just blockchain, you've got things like big data analytics, you've got things like population studies, you've got things like, you know, the big threat intelligence honeypots and things like that, all of these different methods that aren't fundamentally based on a CA or one strongly held private key coming down to one certificate somewhere else. All of these completely change the way that you build your threat models. It doesn't get rid of the crypto altogether, but it moves it somewhere else. And something we're not ready for, I think, is in this great leap forward, is people owning their own crypto keys. Yeah, if you move all of the intelligence out to the endpoints, one of the big things with decentralization as a principle for crypto and for security is that there's no single honeypot to steal stuff from. There's no single back door or no single subvertible entity to go and get the things from. Especially since the Snowden papers and Prism revelations and things, people are really keen on having this kind of openness. But you push some of the hard math problems out to the endpoints, and sure, the economics are really attractive. If you take a pure data science point of view, you know, the economics of going around every single person's blockchain identity and stealing their individual private keys in order to just hack them. In principle, yeah, absolutely. This is a difficult thing to do. You've raised the bar. This is a really secure system. But in practice, people will lose their stuff. And in practice, people will all be using the same version of Android. And the other thing I could have put up from the register this morning was that somebody's published some paper about how Android Lollipop sucks. You could do that about any version of Android. But the point is, you don't have statistically neutral threats once you're in this massively online shared world. You actually have the opportunity to go and attack many, many people at once. And so a lot of the assumptions about the promises behind these things are broken. But nevertheless, they will develop, and we need to keep up with it, especially with things like the population analysis, the big data analytics, because those basically work on letting somebody take the fall and then quickly patching everybody else. Well, that's a great idea in principle, but are you going to be the one who signs up your company to maybe taking the fall one day? I don't know. But we need to work with that. So IoT, another thing that I hate to say, but it's kind of true. IoT is either sort of a decade old or a decade hence, depending on how you look at it, but it's definitely driving a lot of interesting business. And so people who've seen me before will know these things. But I couldn't put the original. The New Yorker original is still copyrighted, and people who put it in their presentations are naughty. But Doge is not. So you know, there's this old famous cartoon from the New Yorker, a Steiner cartoon. On the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. It was very very prescient, because I think it came out it was about 1997 or 98. So it was fairly early days in the internet. But knowing that you can't trust anything, you can't trust anybody. The guy on the other end of the AOL chat room, which I think was the use case at the time, you know, no idea at all. Interestingly, once you get on the Internet of Things, nobody knows you're a dishwasher, or whether you're a dishwasher, or if you're the right dishwasher, because this is actually a fairly good use case. We've got a lot of major companies like Panasonic, Bosch, Siemens, a bunch of others, pouring a lot of money into making smart white goods for, you know, some gratuitous reasons, but some very good reasons. Like, you know, nobody's going to want a dishwasher that has a full sort of Android panel and lots of options and diagnostic settings and call the guy, whatever. You know, in the smart fridge use case that everyone quotes, that it will notice when you're out of milk and order you some more. I'm not sure people are quite ready to have that much interaction with their white goods. But if you can have a dishwasher or a washing machine or something that notices some deeply technical worrying symptom that it's about to break, like the coils overheating or the motor spinning a bit slower than it should do or whatever, and it can automatically go off and phone the maintenance guy under your warranty contract, and they can come in and do some preventive maintenance or sell you another warranty contract or send you a part, whatever, This is kind of cool, but it does require quite a lot of security to make it actually work, to keep the economics going, to make sure that you don't get pooned by your dishwasher. So sometimes you actually want to know that something's a dishwasher. Sometimes you want to know that it absolutely isn't. And sometimes you really would prefer not to care less. And so we really hope that these guys put the right kind of security in, that it doesn't interfere. And this is going to be a big area of home security, whether we like it or not, coming soon, that doesn't in any way fit the old model of a FIPS type module. So in my own experience, I mean, this is a small fraction of my things that I have in my own home for Internet of Things. The colour-changing light bulb, the darling example of Internet of Things for home, was the Philips smart light bulbs. They're really expensive. I didn't buy those, but I've got a different one. If you ever listen to Vint Cerf talking about IoT, he always uses the directly IP-connected light bulb as kind of the example of a thing. And I've never really understood that, because in my home, if I needed to, I only need the light if my eyes are physically present to observe the light, and if my eyes are present, then so are my arms, and I'm never too far away from a thing to just push the normal switch. So lights were relatively late in my home installation, but I discovered when it got to being outdoors that having Internet of Things connected lights and color changing and mood settings and stuff was actually kind of nice, so I did that. But I didn't do it with bulbs that cost $100 each. I did it with a Malaysian copy that cost $20 each. And, well, you can already see the problem. These things are supremely easy to use. In fact, all that you have to do is you turn off, there's a little application that's looking, scanning for these things speaking. You hit the button, you turn it off and on. Within 2 seconds, it emits a little signal, and it gets enrolled on your network. And then from here, were I to care to do so, I could, but for the thing I'm about to show you, over the internet, change the lights in my garden. So somehow, just by turning something on and off within 2 seconds, it's got full access to my network. That's a problem, and yet it has to be that way if any of this is going to work for a normal consumer, because nobody wants to configure stuff, nobody wants to troubleshoot it, and nobody has a working Wi-Fi at home, as you all know, and that's the only reason that t-shirt exists that says, "No, I will not fix your computer," is because that is always the case. You have to have ease of use, but ease of use gets in the way of difficult configurations, which again are a favorite of our community, I'm sad to say, is configuring things to fit your use case and saying, it's okay because if you just press that button there and then set that setting there and then have a different key there, and it's okay. You can't have any of that. And so the kind of security I actually have for this is simply one of these. So the daughter card is special. I've used some of the GPIO, but basically it's a $35 Raspberry Pi, and it's plugged into my network. And all of the security that I value on my Internet of Things there is the fact that I've got a physical air gap between the network that all of the IoT things think they're on, and in some cases think they're sending all their data back to their cloud services, which they're not, and my actual home network. Why is that? Well, because we're already seeing very clear examples of people getting onto these kinds of Internet of Things or using them as a trampoline to then get onto your main network, to then get onto your email, to then read all of your passwords, to then steal all your money from your bank account. And there is no better way of preventing this, because everything has to be easy for the consumer. So this is a real danger. But the type of security that we need to put in is different from our traditional approach with crypto modules. And yet, most people would expect this same community to be fixing that problem. So we've got to change our approach. Now, this is okay in the home, but what about in the office? So it was just over a year ago, I think, that the iKettle stuff was announced, but it's one of many. Internet-connected water boilers, internet-connected coffee machines, multifunction printers, all of these things are providing useful launch points for attacking whatever you like, really. You can get onto a network, as long as you can embed some malware there, then you're fine. And malware in kettles is a real thing. It's been proven, it's been demonstrated. Malware in multifunction printers is a real thing. It's been proven and demonstrated. In fact, it's a very cool way of remotely stealing hard copies, because a lot of these things basically get in the way and either spoof your spooler and make a second copy, or they'll even get underneath and take the cached copies of whatever it was that was being printed and then send them off to whatever nation state was looking for them. So we start to get a little bit more serious, and this is why bring your own device was such a hot topic a little while ago. I think it seems to have disappeared in the lost battle kind of sense. You don't hear too much about bring your own device anymore, and yet it's not really any better than it was, and I hesitate to say that people have just kind of given up. But yeah, so in offices we've already seen attacks where, you know, how on earth do you cope if you still have something of a perimeter mindset or something of a central, this is just the little place where I do my crypto mindset, when your entire network could be permanently owned by something living on the water boiler that just repings every time you wipe the Windows laptop, or something that's sitting on the print spooler and respawns every time you connect to it. It's absolutely dreadful. And even worse, you know, what happens when it's in your cars? First time, I have a slightly different talk on intelligence-based security, because one of the things about crypto modules is that we tend to finish them, and they're kind of perfect in some way. They've got boxes, they've got bounds, they've got security parameters and requirements, they've got lots of nice mathematical provable tests that you can do on them. And yet there are lots of folks out there who are trying to, I think some of them are here, in fact, who are trying to come up with different approaches where you don't really know everything that's going on, and you apply deep learning and AI and things and lots of massive data crunching to your security use case instead, which are always great until they're not, because they always fail eventually. And one of the interesting things about this one is that for a long time, I'd have to make this talk, and we're talking about things like Google Flu Trends, which worked for a couple of years and then didn't work anymore, and they just sort of got rid of it, and lots of other things like that. And all of the same ideas that are horribly disproven in lots of other areas keep on getting recycled and showing up in new use cases, and we ended up with the same kind of not quite working data crunching and AI, very fledgling AI, running our cars. And I used to have to say, you know, this is great until it crashes, and then what do we do? Because I don't need to say that anymore, because it has crashed. I think you probably all know the Google car had an awful lot of experience of driving in normal commuter traffic, and so its AI engine had learned very well that, you know, if it's got about that far and it pulls out really confidently in front of your average commuter, then the commuter would slow down and let it in, you could follow in the traffic. So that's good. And it had learned this over many millions of miles of experience. And so one day there was one of these little Google cars sitting waiting at a junction. It pulled out very confidently and it got hit. Got hit by a bus. Because what it didn't realize is that bus drivers are not as patient or friendly or kind as your average commuter in Silicon Valley traffic. The commuters are, you know, they know they're stuck for 3 hours on the 101 anyway, so I'll give you 3 seconds. The bus driver, he's on a mission, and his bus is harder to stop and start. And so the car pulls out, gets hit, and the response, to be fair, the response was reasonably circumspect, and some of the froth and bravado did dissipate from the driverless cars folks. But nevertheless, the response was, in the end, we'll update the algorithm. Great, okay, until the next thing that you don't know, and the next thing, and the next thing. I mean, how many things do you have to update the algorithm for before you can actually trust it? Now, to be fair, I do believe that driverless cars will still be a lot better than human drivers in the end. Human drivers are rubbish. But the issue is, what happens when you apply the same things to this kind of scale? What happens when you're going for, I think I can read some of the things. So you've got some simple stuff, so open data city bikes, not a problem. If you show up at a bike park and the bike you thought you were going to hire isn't there, well, whatever, it's annoying, but it doesn't matter. But when you get into a whole nation being smart powered by the same kinds of things, when you get into power stations being smart powered by the same kinds of things, well, then you've got an issue. And again, these aren't sort of theoretical things. There was a time when you could give this talk and you'd have to refer back to 24 season 6 when the terrorists were threatening to blow up a power station, and they had to go and steal some special daughter card. I don't know what it did, but there's all kinds of intrigue in managing to get inside the power station and run the turbines and blow it up. It happened about 6 months ago, purely through software networking, because people have opened these things up, because you have to. And the cars are another good example, right, that you have to open them up, because for overall security, if there's a problem with the driving algorithms, you've got to update them. Well, you want to patch those as soon as possible, so you want to have the thing open on the internet. So you got, but at the same time, opening up to getting good patches possibly opens you up to getting bad patches. Same deal with these guys. There's an awful lot of difficult decisions to be made about how open one is. And again, this is totally anathema to the way that we do original crypto modules and original security before, where you'd have a rigid set of people in charge of one thing, and you'd give them all the power of one thing, and then you'd install all the stuff of one thing, and it all kind of works. Completely impossible now. When you get to this kind of scale, everything's connected. There are 100 people in charge of 100 things, and you can't have that perfect view anymore that we had in FIPS and common criteria of protection profiles and so on. And just to make the point that it's really happening, you know, the traditional guys are importing, they're accelerating their business use cases from the Silicon Valley stuff. So this is all going to be running off Cisco and Juniper and Microsoft and AWS and, you know, some of our code. It's absolutely happening that the world that we've grown up in, which is very niche really, if you think about enterprise InfoSec, if you think about government ComSec, it's a tiny piece of the world. As Microsoft just released their numbers, an investor release where they were gleefully trumpeting the number of people they have on Office Online. It's still only 1% of the world's population. Their entire user base that we take as a sort of some big beacon, some example of how the entire world works and how all InfoSec and crypto modules should be designed, at the very most touch 1% of the world's population. That's a tiny thing. And yet it's going into now suddenly touching, well, pretty much everybody. Now, people are concerned about this, of course. This is a Gartner study, and everybody says, oh, we're worried about security. But it's not quite clear that anybody really knows why they're worried about security or what they're going to do about it. And privacy is tellingly very similar. Because something I worry about deeply with the Internet of Things and crypto modules and such is that a crypto module has no morals. There's no ethics to mathematics in the end. And there's very little ethics to engineering. And so the only thing that a security module or some crypto or some key management is going to do is it's going to keep some promises for somebody. Question is, who are they keeping the promises for? I'm going to come back to this in a second. I've lost my slides. I'll come back to that. The issue with these guys here, then, is an engineering point. If we're worried about security, something is springing up in the world to try to address that point. So that people are coming up with plug-in modules. So Samsung Arctic is a well-known example. The Electric Imp is a slightly less well-known example, where instead of people who make washing machines trying to learn all the skills of making smart washing machines and hiring cryptographers and everything else, you just leave a small hole and you do your best at being really good at sort of spinning things around really quickly, and you make the best washing machine you can, and at the last minute you throw in this little module which does all the radios and the internet-y stuff and the software and the crypto and whatever else. Now this is probably a good idea, but it is a little bit lacking in diversity. So if you base all of your security on a small number of things that you put in and that they're all the same, then you end up with a problem the world banana market is facing today, which is a problem of lack of diversity. So originally, if you'd been in the world of 1920s and 30s dinner parties when the banana was a luxury, you would have had something called a St. Clair banana. More than likely, it's a South American variant. It's much closer to the plantain. It's very tasty. It's much tastier than the sort of thing you get from Whole Foods. But the problem was the St. Clair, being kind of natural, was also rather susceptible to natural foes. And a terrible fungus set in, which kind of wiped them out. And luckily enough, back in the 1800s, A chap called Cavendish in the UK had brought back an example of this rare exotic wonder called the banana, and actually cultivated a special version that would grow in England in the rather colder climate, in the less useful soil. And it turned out that this variant of banana was immune to the thing that was threatening the St. Clair, so that today something around 90% of the world banana trade, even though they're grown in these other countries again, the bananas you're eating are probably Cavendish bananas that actually come from England. And it's worked great for us for about the last 60 or 70 years, until now there's a blight on the Cavendish banana which is threatening to wipe those out and is playing havoc with the banana futures market, because nobody knows where they're going to get their next set of the world's most popular fruit from. And we have a similar kind of issue in the Internet of Things and in the Internet, where we're basing, and thanks very much to Tim for fixing one of these, or at least being part of that, but we are facing an issue where we're reusing an awful lot of stuff, and we have an awful lot of common things at the very heart of our security, which is good from the point of view that they're tended to by experts, and they're probably better than anyone could do on their own. But they're catastrophically bad in the event that you do have a problem, because then everybody has the problem all at once and you've got to go fix it. And this is something which we really have to think about. I think on balance, I would rather have my IoT tended to by an Arctic platform, and I would rather have my SSL done by experts. But we can't assume that the day you put in a version of OpenSSL, you're done. Now, I know nobody in this community would think that, but the world at large is doing that. And I think it's incumbent on us to make sure that we fix that impression, that we fix the technology, and that we fix the way these building blocks are used and consumed in order to make a proper secure world. Why are they ignoring best practice and stuff? Because it's all about the money, because they're just doing stuff, right? And it's kind of about this money. I'm not sure whether Bitcoin will really live that long, but Bitcoin 2 might, Bitcoin 3 will, it's coming, something's going to happen. So a little bit about digital money directly, but it's much wider than that. So we've been running, at Talos, we've been running this trend survey for a number of years, and you can see 5,000 IT security experts. So this is not a small study, this is a pretty decent thing. And you're welcome to go to the website and download it. There's a lot of interesting stuff. But the one thing I wanted to pick out here from the study is this trend over time on who is in control of security policy. Because back in 2005, it was pretty much entirely IT operations, and they were buying firewalls. And over time, we've seen this steady trend where now it's lines of business who are taking the initiative, because they're starting to realize that security is an enabler, but they'll only put in stuff which actually runs their own business model. And so what if their business model doesn't match with yours? What if in this great heterogeneous joined up world that we have, that's running lots of people's devices and lots of people's security, that's paid for by their business people, what happens when their business people are not acting in our interests? When your urban area network is looked after by people who are running off your information? One worry that I have about the Internet of Things stuff and the procurement is that I bought the Malaysian copy of the light bulbs because they were cheaper. Now, it's been an issue in the world previously that when you bought components, the expensive one was made of brushed aluminium and had a support line, and the cheap one was made of plastic and had a support email address that never got answered. And that's kind of easy choice to make. Nowadays, they're both the same engineering, and the likelihood is that the cheapness is some kind of subsidized business model. It'll be a data model, it'll be partnerships, it'll be some kind of integration. That's going to be a real issue, again, if you don't control the security module, then you don't control any of the information running through the security module either. And regulation, of course, all over the place. So we can think that people putting in data protection are helping us as crypto module makers and writers and things, but actually, because it's so desperately all over the place, it's very difficult to come up with a single global product that will solve everybody's problems. And it's very difficult to reconcile something like the ISO and the FIPS and the common criteria reforms against something like the European General Data Protection Regulations, for example, which are saying you have to protect all this stuff, but you've also got to comply with local rules, and for heaven's sake, don't lose any, and it's all going to be online. There's an awful lot of work going into this kind of stuff, and it worries me that there's not a lot of output coming out of it. So what can we do? Everything about this fast-moving world is built on shared data. It's number one point. Even if they're not directly selling data, this isn't a Facebook paranoia story, but this is just a fact. You have to be able to share data between sites if you're going to run these kinds of new business models, which is a problem for our traditional users, because mostly when you're building a crypto module, you're looking to control data, and yet everybody else is looking to free it. So a lot of these nice messages that we've been putting out for years about security being an enabler and it's about being able to put out data, share data safely, we've got to start delivering on some of those things now. Certification programs, again, you know, it takes months to go through a certification. Well, if your design life is 6 months total, then going through a 9-month certification just doesn't work, so we've got to fix that. The threats are absolutely different and not statistically neutral. So the fact that it may be only a 1 in a million chance of finding a bug in a shared component, once you've found that bug, you can replicate it 1 million times and everybody gets owned. We've got to deal with that. And we should take that as an opportunity, not as a challenge. So mostly in the commercial use cases, certifications have to be useful to the commercial use case. If they're not, they'll simply ignore us and we'll be wasting our time. In distributed and fragmented world, we have got to be able to join these certifications together. If you think you've got a promise from one module and a promise from another module, they will be joined together at some point in the real world. So we need to understand what it means, and we should design our things to be able to understand what that means. And finally, we have to recognize that nothing is perfect. The old model of building fully packaged, nicely mathematically proven models is nice in very small chunks, but the real world isn't made of very small chunks. The real world is made of a big bag of many chunks of many different sizes, and it makes a lot more sense to be able to be prepared, not for be perfect at launch, but to be able to fix every time there's a problem. And if we start designing our things this way, I think the presidential debate on FIPS versus ISO might go a very different way later on today. So, thank you. Please enjoy the track.
Okay. So, next up we have... do you have your... There we go.